Welcome to session 603 of the Society of American Archivists annual meeting in conjunction with the Council of State Archivists. The title of this session is Getting at the Good Stuff, Declassifying the Most Sensitive Records of the Federal Government. I'm Bill Carpenter from the Information Security Oversight Office at the National Archives. I've got some introductory remarks about mandatory declassification review and the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel. Following that, I'll introduce our panel, and following that, we'll have a period of discussion. Please remember, this session is being recorded, so if you have questions, I will need to repeat them for the panel. Now, this discussion need not be purely about declassification. We'll touch on the dynamics of sitting on an appointed oversight board, and we'll talk about issues surrounding having to represent access questions within an agency that might not necessarily have its main focus of access. A little bit of background on declassification. I want to make sure that you all understand that we're talking about classified national security information, which is information that would cause damage, serious damage, or catastrophic damage to national security if improperly released. It's information that's covered under the provisions of Executive Order 12958 as amended. Classification and declassification since World War II has been exclusively an executive branch responsibility, but there are other reasons why information might be protected from public release, properly or improperly. We'll be discussing those, touching on those other sensitivities having to do with executive privilege or privacy or things like that, but our main focus will be declassification. Executive Order 12958 was signed by President Clinton in 1995. It established the revolutionary principle of automatic declassification. It means that information contained in permanent federal records that is security classified will be automatically declassified at 25 years unless it has been specifically exempted from automatic declassification. As a result, starting in the late 1990s, federal agencies have developed comprehensive declassification review programs that have resulted in the declassification of over a billion pages of records since then. Now, the big challenge now is getting those records available to the public. Now, the Freedom of Information Act, established in the 1960s and given teeth in the early 1970s, is another avenue of gaining access to classified information. It operates under very different regulatory and legislative frameworks from the executive order procedures. We'll be touching on that, but again, our focus will be on 12958 as amended, and we'll be concentrating on mandatory declassification review. So what is MDR? It's a means by which any individual or entity can request in any agency to review classified information for declassification, regardless of its age or origin, subject to certain limitations set forth in the order. Now, records must be described by the requester with sufficient specificity to enable the agency to locate it with a reasonable amount of effort. The records of the current administration are excluded from these provisions, but records of past administrations are not, but those records might also be covered by other access restrictions. All agencies must have a process for tracking these requests and have an agency-level appeal mechanism, and that becomes significant later on when we talk about the ICE cap. Now, the big question here is how do researchers frame their requests in a way that is specific enough for agencies to act upon them? And there's two main ways that come to my mind. The first is by requesters paying attention to withdrawal notices inserted in processed declassified records at presidential libraries and at the National Archives in College Park. When archivists are dealing with declassified records and a particular document has been identified as still containing classified national security information, that document is withdrawn, a withdrawal notice inserted in its place, and the classified document placed in a parallel series. Researchers will see that withdrawal notice, and they can use that to file a very targeted mandatory declassification review request. Second way, the researchers can frame their requests with sufficient specificity is by paying attention to references in previously declassified documents and increasingly references in reports such as the 9/11 Commission report and the Weapons of Mass Destruction report that would use classified documents as sources. Those sources are listed in footnotes or endnotes, and those notes can be used to frame very specific targeted requests. So what is the ICE cap? It's the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel that provides the public and users of the classification system with a forum for further review of classification decisions. There are three well-defined areas that the ICECAP has jurisdiction. The first has to do with deciding on appeals for classification challenges lodged under Section 1.8 of the order. Those people in the federal government who have access to classified information have an obligation and an expectation to challenge the classification status of documents they believe are improperly classified. The ICECAP is the final arbiter for appeals for those. I mentioned Guantanamo Bay in the material in our program. One of the classification challenges recently decided upon by ISCAP had to do with that precise area. Second function is to approve, deny, or amend application by agency heads to exempt information under Section 3.3B of the order. That's the section that has to do with automatic declassification. If the Army, for example, wants to extend the classification or exempt information from being automatically declassified at 25 years, they have to describe that type of information very specifically in a declassification guide. Those declassification guides are approved and edited by the ISCAP. The third function has to do with deciding on these appeals for MDR. Recently, ISCAP has been held forth as a model for interagency cooperation and oversight by organizations like the Federation of American Scientists and others. So we can talk about that later. So who sits on the ISCAP? It's senior-level representatives of the Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. That's the National Security Advisor at the National Security Council. We have the Department of Defense, Department of State, Department of Justice, Central Intelligence Agency, and the National Archives and Records Administration. Now, NARA is on the list because it's alone among these six agencies as having at the core of its mission information access. NARA does not have original classification authority and relatively constrained declassification authority, but it's the main equity holder for historical information. The President appoints the ISCAP's chair from among its members. Right now, that is William Leary from the National Security Council. Now, the panelists only meet once or twice a year. They exercise their authority primarily through the hard work of their liaisons. We have three of the liaisons on our panel today. The director of ISU, Jay Basanko, serves as the executive director of the panel. He doesn't vote, but he can set the agenda. And ISU staff, like myself, provide program and administrative staff support. We handle correspondence between requesters and agencies. We collect the classified documents. We prepare briefing books. We prepare redaction proposals. Everything we do is governed by the order. Section 5.3 of the order establishes the ISCAP. It first met in 1996. The bylaws, which have very specific deadlines for both agencies and requesters to follow, are contained in Appendix A to 32 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 2001. All of these regulations are available on the ISU and ISCAP websites, and there's links in this presentation. This presentation is available on the SAA website. The panel advises and assists the President in the discharge of his constitutional and discretionary authority. It is a presidential panel. The members and the liaisons do not only represent the interests of their agencies, they are exercising the authority of the President. The records that are generated by the ISCAP are presidential records. In January, we shipped off 62 boxes of ISCAP records, largely classified but not all classified, to the George W. Bush Library. Agency heads can appeal ISCAP decisions, and the Director of National Intelligence has a special role in Section 5.3F of the amended order from 2003. That special role to appeal to prevent the release of specific intelligence information really has only been exercised once. One of the things that the Information Security Oversight Office does is collect statistics from agencies about their declassification programs. It's been reported to us that agencies have reviewed 2.8 million pages under the MDR program since 1996. In 61% of those cases, the records had been declassified in full. Out of those 2.8 million pages, only 60,000 pages had been internally appealed to the agency. Out of those 60,000 pages that were internally appealed, 769 documents have come to the ISCAP. You can see in 35% of the time, the panel has affirmed the classification of those documents. It's upholding the previous decision of the agencies. But in 65% of the time, additional information has been released. What we see are redactions getting smaller and smaller. We can see our own workload getting larger and larger. Back in 1996, the ISCAP only received 5 requests. In 2008, 63. So far, in 2009, we've received 82 appeals. I'm not afraid to tell you that we have a backlog. There is a limit to the current capability of what the ISCAP can handle. This really needs to become a full-time job. It's not full-time for me. It's not full-time for our panelists. Some sample documents. The first one has to do with Israel nuclear weapons from 1960. This is a special national intelligence estimate from nearly 40 years ago. Again, this is contained in the presentation on the SAA website. This was requested by the National Security Archive, and it went through the agency appeal process. It finally came through ISCAP, and more information was declassified towards the end. You can see we have, well, you probably can't see it, but there is a very clear declassification block on the first page of the document that indicates this is an ICECAP decision. On the second page, information has been determined by the panel to still contain information that would harm national security if released because of intelligence sources and methods. The specific redaction code is 3.3B1, and that's indicated in a sticker on the document. A couple more, the Arab-Israeli War postmortem report from 1973. This is a highly classified document. This contains sensitive compartmented information. Just because it's SCI information doesn't mean it's excluded from mandatory declassification review. Much more information was declassified in this document from the original appeal. Likelihood of terrorist acts by terrorist groups, 1986. This is not quite 25 years old. Current information, or information that hasn't reached the point for automatic declassification, is still applicable under MDR. I hesitate to bring this one up. This is the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel memo from 2002. This is one of the ones that's popularly known as the torture memo. It's this kind of document that tends to raise questions in the public mind about the coherence of the declassification program. And it probably erodes public confidence in the classification system as well. There's no classification block on this document. It doesn't tell us who classified the document. It doesn't even tell us who declassified the document. And there is no redaction codes for the information that was not released. A document looking like this will not come out of the ICECAP shop, I'll tell you that. We have links. We have ICECAP website, MDR website, which includes lists of mandatory declassification review contacts at federal agencies, which is the first step in filing in MDRs. We have our ISU website, and again, like most NARA people, I apologize for the state of the ISU website. We are hoping to improve it in the future. Contact information for our director, Jay Basenko, as well as contact information for myself. Which brings me to the panelists. Mary Ronan has been working with the National Archives for 26 years. She has performed review on records for classification, declassification, Freedom of Information Act, and Privacy Act for the entire time she's been with NARA. She has been the head of the access staff at the National Archives, as well as FOIA and Privacy Act officer at NARA. She spent a Babylonian exile of 5 years at the IRS doing as a privacy advocate. But since 2006, she's been detailed to the National Security Council, where she's the director of access management. She's the National Security Council's liaison to the ICECAP. She has a BA from Emanuel in Boston, an MA from Wisconsin, and is finishing another MA in the history of decorative arts. And she's angling for the job of picking the colors for classified cover sheets. Next to her, we have David Mengel. David has worked for the National Archives since 1991. Over his career at NARA, he has worked in records declassification, in FOIA, the Office of Presidential Libraries, the Nixon Presidential Materials Staff, and he's currently chief of the Special Access and FOIA staff. Along the way, he has supervised review of the Nixon tapes. He was a member of the NARA panel established to determine if current technology could recover that 18.5-minute gap. And he's worked on the review of 9/11 commission records. He's the NARA liaison to ICECAP and is currently detailed to work on the concept of operations for the National Declassification Center. I should have mentioned that Executive Order 12958 that governs classification and declassification of documents is currently under review. At the end of May, President Obama directed agency heads to prepare another draft of 12958. And we can look forward, on a short 90-day period, so we can look forward to another change to that. Next to David is David Daly. Dave is the Department of Defense's liaison to ICECAP, and he's been doing that for several years. He's a security review specialist at the DoD Office of Security Review, which performs pre-publication review of manuscripts, technical documents, presentations, and congressional statements. He's held a variety of other declassification and disclosure programs in DoD. He's a retired Air Force officer, helicopter instructor pilot, and he was air attaché to the American Embassy in Germany for a period of time. He's an Air Force Academy graduate and has an MA in International Relations from Webster University. And he told me last night that when he was a kid, him and his family drove from Karachi, Pakistan to London in a Citroen. So not something you could really do anymore. Also. Which brings me to the final panelist, is Dr. Burr. William Burr is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive at the George Washington University. He directs the documentation project on U.S. nuclear security. He's the editor of several of the National Security Archive's documentation collections, including the Kissinger transcripts. He's published articles in many academic journals and has served on the Council of the Society for the Historians of American Foreign Relations. We'll start with our panelists.
Thank you, Bill. As Bill said, I'm Mary Ronan, and I am a Narshan from a long time ago, and still, and I'm on detail for the to the National Security Council, and I need to make the normal federal rejoinder that I'm talking about my experience and my opinions and not in any sense the National Security Council's or let alone the President of the United States. I am going to talk about being a liaison on the ICECAP panel. As Bill said, there are members, the statutory members, and then there are liaisons. I've been it twice. Between 1996 and 2001, I was the NARA liaison to the panel since 2006. It just seems like long. Since I came back, I have been the NSC liaison to the panel. And what I've seen is a serious evolution in process and a serious evolution in results. And that evolution seems to me very logical because the panel really has no place in the executive order. The liaison has no place in the executive order. It was, I think, an ad hoc decision on the part of the panel members when they realized exactly how much work there was involved in declassification and review. And anybody who in this audience is familiar with declassification review would know immediately, long before the panel members did, how much work was involved. What I've seen is an attitude change. I've seen the liaisons, I think in the beginning, didn't really have any sense of identity as liaisons. They were there to represent NARA, the CIA, the Department of Defense. There was no corporate sense of we're the liaisons, we're the ICECAP panel, this is the kind of thing we do. I've also seen a process change, a deep process change. In the beginning, the ISU staff, who are our linchpin at the moment, were very much less involved. They made photocopies of the documents, sent them to you, you did the review, you went and talked about it, that was it. I, as the NARA person, was doing research, what's already been published in FRUS, what does the Kennedy Library already have available at that point even online, what have we released in the past. I don't think any of the other ICECAP liaison members were doing that. And part of that, I think, was people were still working under the old mentality of what was classified is classified. People in the mandatory review world had very little experience with appeals. Bill talked about the number and the small number of denials or reviews that are appealed today. I think there were even less then. I looked at the numbers. In 96, we dealt with 5 appeals, and that was it. And they almost all came from the presidential libraries. Presidential libraries were the chief, researchers at presidential libraries were the chief users of mandatory review. There was really little movement, I think, and what little movement there was glacial. Some of the numbers that Bill showed you in terms of how much we've declassified, what percentage were declassified in part or released in part, meant that an additional sentence or an additional paragraph was released, and that's really all that was released in those early documents. We had a deeply split ICECAP panel. We had a deeply split liaisons panel. Very long, contentious meetings. John Powers, who's not here today, reminded us at a recent ICECAP meeting, a liaisons meeting, that there were times we sat and argued for an hour and a half over whether we could release the phrase "and the." That doesn't happen anymore very much. I came back in 06 and the world seems to have changed. It really was a brave new world, a brave new world in ICECAP, and I would have to say, having been off doing privacy issues for 5 years, it was also a brave new world in the rest of the declassified world. I would get a packet of documents from my staff to do second review and sign off on the letter out, and I would look at them and say, no, we need to refer this to X agency, and the response was, X agency's already looked at it and they're okay with it. We've got a long way to go, but I would have to say we really have come a long way in the last 5 years. Agencies have become comfortable with the idea of automatic declassification. The world, I think, really has gone to hell in a handbasket since 2001, but it's not gone to hell in a handbasket because of any documents any of us have declassified. Nobody blew up the World Trade Center based on documents we declassified. So it's the idea of declassification, at least at the agency working stiff level, I think is becoming more and more open. And that's also true in the ISCAP. Also incredibly valuable in the ISCAP has been the work of the ISU staff. And I say it not just because Bill is sitting next to me. They are our primary researchers. They go out, they take the documents, and when they send them back to the agencies, or when they go back to the agency, their now line is, could you look at this one more time and make sure you really need to hold all of this? When it comes back, they produce for all of us a straw man document. And the straw man document is, at that point, maybe some of the silliness, some of the duplication. No, you're releasing it on page 9, you can't hold it on page 12. That's either gone or at least it's identified so that the liaisons can say, okay, no, open on page 8, you can't open it on page, you can't close it on page 13. And then there is kind of the corporate culture of the liaisons, which really has grown up. And for those of you who've worked on committees and worked on successful committees, I would suggest you recognize the fact that for a committee to be successful, that's the kind of thing that needs to have happened. I think it's working for several reasons for the liaisons. We are in the right place in the hierarchy of our agencies, our institutions. We're working stiffs, okay? We are at the level which we either will review or we know the right people to ask to review the documents. And we are then in a place that we can interpret or evaluate the responses we get back from the specific reviewers, and we are in a place where we can go back and question them. You know, last week you told me this. How come it's this week? On the other hand, we've all been around the block a bit. I certainly have been around the block a bit. And we have kind of a broader view of what constitutes harm. We've seen what constitutes harm, we've seen what's not constitutes harm. We look at declassification guides, and every agency has a responsibility to have a declassification guide so their reviewers know what it's appropriate to hold and what it's not appropriate to hold. And we look at them as guides. We don't look at them as divine revelation. This government protects any number of its covert actions. But the fact that Gary Powers was shot down is no longer a covert action. And we know it, and will not allow an agency to continue to hold those kind of things. We've also got, I think, for all of us, we have members who will, if we convince them that this is the way to go, and so the members will vote, the members have enough clout back in an agency or back in the National Security Council to see that that process gets implemented. One of the things I've seen in another interagency committee around the executive order is, people have really good ideas. People work really well together, but they then don't have the clout to go back to their agency and say, this is how we're going to do it. Our members are there behind us for that. The other thing I've also seen is the growing confidence we have with each other. The confidence is that the other members have done their homework, that the information that they're proposing to excise on page 3, it's not just a knee-jerk reaction. Somebody's actually looked at it and thought, yeah, maybe this needs to be withheld. That our colleagues have gone back and pushed their agencies if necessary. You told me yesterday it was okay. How come in this document it's not? While at the same time, I would have to acknowledge that some of our agencies don't take to pushing back very graciously. There are some things you can't get done. So we've come a long way. And I'd like to end my bit of time, because I know Bill is a serious taskmaster and will shut me off when I get to the 10-minute point, is by leaving you with an idea that this is all wonderful and this has all worked. But I'm too much of an Irish peasant to say that. I'm afraid I'm much more, in this case, a glass half empty rather than glass half full thing. And there are several reasons for my pessimism. The title of this program notwithstanding, it's not just the good stuff we get. We see enormous amount of things that should have been released on their initial review by agency reviewers, or certainly on the appeals. And instead, they come to us. And sometimes ICECAP staff or agency liaison can maneuver and get some of that done before it reaches the whole liaison panel. Sometimes they can't. My predecessor in the job at NSC, a man named Rod Sobers, who many of you may know, used to refer to say that declassification was an art, it wasn't a science. And he's right. But I think that what ICECAP ought to be looking at is those issues where reasonable women disagree. What is it that can be released? What is it that can't? Rather than the kind of level of stuff we're still seeing. Our speed. We've picked up a lot in the last year. We meet many more times. We should meet more times, but nobody has the ability to do that. We've done more cases, more pages, more review in the last 8 months than we've done in the past. But in Bill's numbers, he told you that we've reviewed 769 pages and that there have been about 3 million pages reviewed across the board in this government over the last 13 years. On Thursday before I came, I talked to Sherry Fletcher at the Reagan Library. She says she has 8 million pages in her classified vault. Of the 8 million pages, they expect that 5 or 6 million of those pages are actually classified. But the other stuff around them, you still have to handle. Your archivist, you know, you still have to handle. The Clinton Library, rumor has it, also has 8 million pages. But that's just their email. That's nothing else. We're doing sedan chair review in an age in which we need jumbo jets.
David Mengel.
Good morning, everyone. Can you all hear me okay up the back? Okay, good. Wouldn't want you to miss anything. As Bill stated earlier, the National Archives currently has no classification. And we actually have never had classification authority and very, very limited declassification authority. So why are we involved in this process? Well, I'll try to lay that out for you and fill you in on our role in the declassification process a little bit and our perspective on the ICECAP. But first, let me tell you...
Okay.
Too close?
That's too far.
Okay. This was not always the case. Early in our declassification career as the archives, we did have more authority to do declassification work. This was under the previous executive order. We were given guidelines by agencies and the authority to apply them to declassify general historical information that's found in our collections. We no longer have these guidelines. We hold millions of pages of classified documents, historical documents, going back as early as World War I, I think, is our first or earliest classified, all the way up through, we have 9/11 commission records, so we've got classified that are very recent. As I said, no declassification guides. We cannot apply these. In past, under the previous order, we were able to do systematic review. We could identify a collection, and our reviewers would sit down and review this collection, declassify large portions of it, and identify the specific information that was sensitive to the agencies. This is no longer happening. That responsibility or that burden has been placed back on the agencies under this order. Our role in the process right now is a facilitator for, one, referral actions, meaning if a researcher asks for a document, we refer that document to the appropriate agencies for their review. Another aspect of that is something that's established right now in College Park. It's called the National Declassification Initiative. And it's a, among other things, it has a referral center function where we bring agencies into the building. They do their declassification review on site. For instance, if NSC determines that a document needs to be seen by DOD, we would have that document ready and available for DOD to do their review. If they need to send it on to state or to whoever else, that we facilitate that process within the agency. We continue to do FOIA and MDR processing, which I know Dr. Burr takes advantage of quite frequently, and as do many other researchers. I see several colleagues from presidential libraries who deal a lot in the MDR process as well as the FOIA process for some of the newer libraries. the ice cap. I have to say, I have to give Mary a lot of credit. As she said, she was our first ice cap liaison. She laid the groundwork for how we process this, how we fill out our role on the panel, what we do. Our role, in my mind, this is my own personal opinion and the way I approach the ice cap, is we're there to provide historical perspective. Over the years that I've been doing declassification review, I've found that agencies are very focused on the information itself. They look at a document, they look at the information in that document, and determine whether or not that information is classified. Often, they don't look at the big picture. They look at intelligence from World War II and say, this is classified, it's intelligence information. They don't look at the big picture to determine what's been released in the past, what's known out there in the public. What are we holding? Is this the right thing to be holding? How are the records in the archives that support or provide context to this specific document? What do they reveal about the information we're holding? So our role at the archives is to sort of provide a little historical perspective in that. I can't tell you, and I'm sure Mary and David will vouch for me, a lot of times my comeback to a particular document is, but that was in 1962. You know, why today? Why is it important today? You know, in 1962, this and this were happening at the same time. You know, all of that's known. Why is that specific piece of information important? Why does it need to be protected? And that brings me to my favorite question is, why? It's actually the best part of this role for me, is I get to ask why. I don't have a stake in this. I have no classification authority. I have no declassification authority. I get to ask, why do you want this held? Why does it need to be held? What significance is it today? Why are you holding this to protect something that's important today? Which is sometimes a question that just needs to be asked. We do, or try to do, as follow the example that Mary set up, we try to do research into our collection. If we find that there's a document that's relevant to a collection that we have, we'll go back and do a little research. We'll look at some open source material. We'll try to come back to the panel with an example. We had one just recently, a document, a current appeal that we're working on, where the panel came back with a decision on a document. We went back and we found the same document that had been previously released. We took it back and said, look, this is what was done before. You know, we need to match this up. In all, I think I'll second Mary's opinion here that the ice cap is working, especially with the liaisons we have right now. We've got a great group. I have confidence in every one of them that when they come in with a decision from their agency, that they've done the best they can to redact that in a way that everybody will agree on. I know the ice cap was originally set up with the principals meeting monthly. I think we're down to what, meeting annually now for the principals?
Once or twice a year, tops.
And a lot of that is due to my colleagues on the panel. They're doing what they can to get these documents resolved so that we don't have to take it to the higher level. We don't have to have the fights at the principal's level over the and the portion of this document. We're able, as Mary said, to go out to the working level, find out what we need to do, get that document released in the best form we can. And I think that's been one of the biggest successes of this. I have to also second Mary's opinion that, and Bill mentioned this earlier, that we do have a backlog at ICECAP. We all have day jobs. This is not our full-time position. We meet, right now we're meeting, what, twice a month? And I have an office to run. I have a special project I've been detailed to. I don't always have the time. I've actually pulled another person in to help me to do some of the research work to facilitate this process. But as the number of appeals goes up, our workload increases considerably. And it's becoming more and more difficult to do this as a part-time position. So I think I'm going to end a little bit early.
Thank you.
If that's all right with you.
David Daly is next.
Good morning. My name is David Daly, and I serve as the DOD liaison to the ISCAP. I'm actually a security reviewer. As Bill alluded, none of us are full-time devoted to the ISCAP process, and my office basically reviews documents generated within DOD by DOD members, active or even retired. We're sort of a pre-publication review to make sure that descriptions of DOD policy are accurate and that no currently classified information is released before something is published or released to the public. We also review, for the same reasons, any documents going from DOD for presentation to Congress, as well as we provide a service to defense contractors to review their information documents for compliance with the International Trade in Arms Regulations, basically that none of the information they're releasing would be export controlled before they present it to a trade fair or some professional journal. I thought I'd just discuss a little bit about how the MDR process works within DOD and then my role as an appeal comes to the ISCAP. If you go to the ISCAP website that Bill presented there for MDR, you'll find 26 DOD components listed, the offices and addresses for all these DOD components that process MDR requests. So when you request the review of a classified DOD document, you have to know which component, for example, Army, Air Force, Navy, Southern Command, DARPA, originated the document, and that's where you begin your MDR request. Once that component has reviewed the document and then either released it in full, redacted it, or denied it in full, you have the requester has the right of an appeal to that DOD component that will then be processed, and then a response is given by that DOD component with the advice that you have a final appeal right to the ISCAP. And that's pretty much where I get involved. When a DOD document is appealed to the ISCAP, Bill and his staff will request the document in question and the correspondence files that have been held by the DOD component. I will retrieve those, get those to the ISCAP staff, who will then prepare a briefing book. In the meantime, I will go to the subject matter expert to do a review of the document as it was redacted or denied after the final MDR appeal, and determine what additional releases could be made or what justification to deny or redact parts of the document exist. And then at this particular document then will be placed on the agenda of an ISCAP liaison's meeting, at which time I will more or less present the document as we, all the liaisons, will go through that document, basically looking at all the redactions. And I will listen to my colleagues on the ISCAP liaison team argue either for or against and try to answer the question why that David asks quite often. And then we will come to an agreement at some point and prepare a final redaction proposal that we then as liaisons present to our ISCAP members, our principal members, and once they have agreed with our redaction proposal, that document can then be released to the requester, and then most of the cases I've been involved in, we've released a lot additional information than was originally withheld during the MDR process. And I'd just like to give a short example of one I dealt with here recently. And actually, Dr. Burr was involved in this as the appellant. He requested an ISCAP appeal review of 19 documents that belonged to Secretary McNamara's holdings at NARA that dealt with presidential draft memoranda from the 1960s dealing with nuclear strategy. So these had been gone through the MDR process, as I described, and there were lots of redactions, as you might imagine. By the way, these 19 documents total about 500 pages, and there were a lot of redactions. So there was when I got the briefing book, I then took it to the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Matters, who are basically the nuclear strategy experts, and do a lot of review as a result of FOIA and the MDR requests. So I spent a couple afternoons going through this, going through these 19 documents, basically redaction by redaction, line by line, either justifying why something should remain redacted or, in a lot of cases, finding out that this information no longer needed to be classified. You may remember on the slide, one of the that Bill showed, there, one of the categories that the ISCAP cannot review restricted data or formally restricted data, which is controlled by the Department of Energy and DOD for the formally restricted data. So these documents contain a lot of that type of information, but because the person I was reviewing with did have that DOD experience and was an expert in FRD information, he was able to decide within these large paragraphs and pages of withheld information, determine which numbers or essential information was at the core of the FDR, made that whole paragraph FDR, and as a result, we were able to release a lot of information and just withhold the bare numbers or figures or descriptions that were the essential FRD information. So once I had all these basically proposed releases, I presented those to the ISCAP staff, and they marked up the document with their nice color coding, automated color coding redaction material. And then we, as ISCAP liaisons, met and had these briefing books then with the proposed releases, and spent I think it was over four liaison meetings over a couple of months.
Yeah.
And part of that was not only the sheer volume, but again, the process is to for me to justify why certain information has to be withheld, or in the case, as Mary alluded to, we found the State Department representative found a Foreign Relations of the United States document with the exact same memo that had been released under FRUS, and we compared it, and other than an and or a the, we basically were releasing everything that had been released during the FRUS process, which was good. In another case, we found out that there was a national intelligence estimate that had been declassified in the, I believe in the 1980s or 90s, that dealt with Soviet nuclear information that we had been withholding for obvious reasons, sensitivity. But when we found this, essentially all this information came from this NIE, then we realized that we could release all this information. So at the end of the entire process, we just had all of our principal members vote on the final redaction of these 19 documents, And Dr. Burr will be happy to know that I will be releasing the final, you know, ISCAP approved volume to him with a lot more releases than he got after the MDR appeal. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to one of our best customers at ISCAP, Dr. Burr.
Thank you. Thanks for the very good, very interesting presentations. I was glad to hear them before I talked because they laid out a lot of assumptions that I don't have to explain as I give my presentation. So I'm going to talk about my experience with MDR and ISCAP over the last, I guess, 15 years or so. At the National Security Archive, I began making mandatory review requests in the early 1990s for a project on the Berlin crisis during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. This meant filling out the MDR forms, mandatory review forms, required by the presidential libraries, and I did this without much enthusiasm. Then I saw little advantage to using MDR compared to making FOIA requests, Freedom Information Act requests. I saw little advantage at that time. When ISCAP came along, the chance for a second appeal began to put mandatory review in a far more favorable light, which subsequent experience confirmed. At the archive, I filed mandatory review requests for requesting documents relating to my project, first on the Berlin crisis, as I said, and more recently on U.S. nuclear weapons policy, as well as some related projects on the Nixon and Ford administrations. My work on U.S. nuclear weapons policy has focused on the U.S. force structure, war planning, command and control, alliance relations, and more recently, on the problem of nuclear proliferation. I've also looked at the role of nuclear threats and deployments in various crises and confrontations during the Cold War. What has made this research and requesting possible is the support of several small and large foundations who believe that the declassification of documents on U.S. nuclear policy, especially historical material, is important for the sake of transparency and greater accountability in government. While some secrecy is obviously essential, for example, information on nuclear weapons design, maximum feasible openness is also necessary because the public ought to know as much as possible about U.S. government policy on the most destructive weapons in human history. When I started the nuclear project, I used FOIA for most of my requests. I used Freedom Information Act for most of my requests on nuclear weapons issues during the 1990s. I used MDR only when necessary, when required by the presidential libraries. But experience and changes in the executive order led me to shift course and began to use mandatory review more routinely. In part, this is because I had pretty negative experience with FOIA appeals to the CIA and the Defense Department. The dysfunctions in the U.S. government's dysfunctional classification, declassification system are supremely evident, I think, in the way that the Pentagon processes FOIA requests and appeals, certainly in the area of nuclear policy. In contrast, I've had reasonably positive experience with requests and with appeals and requests to the Pentagon's MDR staff, but especially with my appeals to ISCAF, which I believe plays a far more objective and balanced role in reviewing appeals than any one agency can. So as Mary suggested, when agencies won't declassify what should be declassified, ISCAP makes the difference in many cases. If I have enough information about the documents that I'm requesting, I'll use the mandatory review procedure, except in those rare instances where the archive might want to litigate, because we do litigate once in a while in our FOIA requests, very rarely, but sometimes we want to have the right, the option. I requested a variety of material for most of the major national security agencies in my MDR request. For example, when I have information on specific CIA documents, such as estimates on nuclear proliferation, their titles and dates, I'll certainly file an MDR. Sometimes I requested documents that I failed to get through FOIA. The FOIA didn't work, but I went to mandatory review and ISCAP, and I actually got the documents I couldn't get through FOIA. I made requests to the State Department for cable traffic, to the Pentagon for documents stored at the Record Center, and to NARA for records withheld from various files out there in College Park. Of course, greater use of MDR is a double-edged sword, because as more requesters become aware of the advantages, the queue of appeals before ISCAP has lengthened, as we've heard. Some requests I filed that sold me on the merits of the ISCAP process involve presidential library documents on what is called nuclear predelegation policy. During the 1950s, when the Eisenhower administration was grappling with the implications of Soviet long-range bombers and ballistic missiles, they considered worst-case scenarios, including what would happen if Moscow launched a nuclear strike at Washington, D.C., and the president was either killed or otherwise could not be reached. What officials at the Pentagon and the NSC wanted was a system in place that would allow top military commanders to make decisions to retaliate quickly against a Soviet attack if they could be certain the nuclear weapons were indeed detonating on U.S. territory. The system of advance authority, of advance authorization, became known as pre-delegation, and President Eisenhower asked for a set of instructions to establish procedures for the worst-case situations. Thanks to the pioneering research of David Allen Rosenberg, I knew there were relevant documents at the Eisenhower and the Johnson Libraries, and I filed requests for them. One archivist unwisely told me that I would never get these documents declassified, so that made me very careful to file my appeals on time. Let no delay occur. Early denials were not a surprise, but I was able to find enough information in the public record to draft reasonably persuasive appeals to ISCAP. Around 1998, ISCAP, then chaired by Steve Garfinkel, ruled in my favor in some of the key documents, such as Eisenhower's request for pre-delegation instructions and another document presented to President Johnson in 64 by George Money, another document summarizing the instructions to commanders that Johnson had approved. And there's a slide which will show you the before and after.
Pre-delegation.
That's before the ISCAP appeal and what ISCAP released. So you can see it made an enormous difference to get the actual content of the document. And this is, 10 years ago. The document showed that Stanley Kubrick was not off base in Dr. Strangelove when he portrayed President Muffley and General Turgidson discussing Plan R for Robert, as you might recall, which was a plan for pre-delegation. Now, ISCAP decisions to reverse the early denials on pre-delegation may not have been its first such reversals, but certainly was very early in the ISCAP's history, I think, to reverse agency decisions on sort of key documents. Now, I'm still on the trail for pre-delegation materials for the 1960s and 70s, and some of the relevant documents are now under appeal at ISCAP, or will soon be considered, I suppose. U.S. nuclear war plans are another difficult subject where MDRs and appeals to ISCAP have made a difference. I started off by requesting documents on the early history of a single integrated operational plan, or SIOP, the National Nuclear War Plan created during the Cold War by the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. Even before I started filing requests, the research of David Rosenberg and Fred Kaplan showed that the SIOP was a massively destructive plan involving thousands of nuclear weapons whose detonations would have caused hundreds of millions of casualties. While the actual war plan may never be declassified, or not for a long time, histories prepared by the Strategic Air Command at Offutt are more accessible and can help historians trace the process by which the SIOP was created and explore its basic assumptions, its basic characteristics. Back in the 1990s, I used the FOIA to request SIOP histories for fiscal years 1962 and 1963. But the FOIA releases were massively excised, even though key details had been declassified in the early 1980s. So I waited. I had to wait a few years under the executive order. I had to wait 2 years to make a request to ISCAP. So I made the request. The request went through the mandatory review process. I got more information from the MDR staff at the Pentagon. It was a pretty good initial release. I appealed again, got even more information, but I still thought more could be released, so I went to ISCAP to see what would happen. Certainly the MDR releases, including the ISCAP decisions, led to results that significantly advanced our knowledge of U.S. nuclear weapons policy in a key area. For example, the documents showed that there were great controversy within the government over the war plan, over SIOP 62. Navy and Army leaders and some scientists worried about the problem of overkill, that the plan was so destructive that the blast would create radioactive hazards for U.S. allies and U.S. troops on the Soviet Union's periphery in Japan and South Korea. They'd be exposed to fallout by attacks on the Soviet Union. Moreover, the plan included automatic attacks on Soviet allies like China, even if they were not in the war. This prompted the Marine Corps Commandant, David Shoup, to declare memorably, this is a quote, that any plan that murdered 300 million Chinese when it might not even be their war is not a good plan. That is not the American way. And then the commander of the target planning said, well, it would screw up the plan to take China out. We wanted to keep China in it. Otherwise, it will screw up the plan. So once they got briefings, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and other top Kennedy administration officials were appalled by the SIOP's tremendous destruction and by its inflexibility. What they wanted more options that would give the president more control and somehow reduce the destructiveness. The history of PSYOP 63, as released through mandatory review and by ISCAP, provides very good information on how the Pentagon and the target planning staff tried to make the war plan more responsive to civilian authorities by giving them more choices. Thus, the new PSYOP included 5 major attack plans instead of 1, although they were still so huge that the overkill problem remained. There are also withholds that allow the White House to exclude attacks against China if China or other Soviet satellites like Poland or Czechoslovakia were not in the war. ISCAP made a very good call in releasing more details from these histories, but in a few areas it held information back. For example, from the PSYOP 63 history, it excised the numbers of designated ground zeros in the various options. For plans from almost 50 years ago, I think this is a bit too much secrecy, but I suspect that the Pentagon insisted on keeping the numbers classified. And this could be an FRD problem. I'm not sure exactly what the issue is. As I suggested earlier, ISCAP is one of the more functional elements in our dysfunctional secrecy system. But the dysfunctions do intrude on ISCAP's authority because there are areas of secrecy policy where it cannot operate. For example, as already been suggested, on some nuclear weapons information, such as overseas deployments of nuclear weapons during the Cold War, ISCAP's hands are tied, and it cannot declassify so-called formally restricted data, or FRD, even when the restrictions may serve no legitimate purpose anymore. ISCAP is also encumbered by legislative restrictions on CIA information. As sort of a test, I filed a request to CIA for a history of the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, during the 1940s and early 50s. The U.S.'s first Cold War covert operations organization, OPT, to some extent, was the brainchild of George F. Kennan, who supervised its early work from the desk of the State Department. I've had a longstanding interest in the history of the early years of the CIA, so I made a request for this OPC history. And I got it, but it was massively excised. Maybe 90% of the document was excised. I appealed, the agency stood its ground, and ISCAP reviewed it. But ISCAP found its hands tied by the CIA Act of 1986, which prevents requesters, MDR FOIA requesters, from getting at operational documents. The history is not an operational document, but in 2006, the agency decided that certain records like the OPC history were operational records and subject to the exclusion. In light of this, the CIA had concluded that it was actually, they should not have released the document in the first place, but they couldn't walk the cat back, they couldn't take it away, they just wouldn't release more information. Now, this is a problem because under the CIA Act, the agency is supposed to find ways to make older records more searchable for FOIA and MDR requests. But what was done instead is to expand the categories of excluded records. Now, this is something that Congress ought to look into, the extent to which the agency has been following the letter and spirit of the 1986 CIA Act. There's a problem there, I think. Another problem is the CIA has a veto over ISCAP decisions, which it got in 2003, and it's not been used as far as I know, but it's a problem because it's a sort of a threat to ISCAP's rule, ISCAP's procedures. It's a threat to ISCAP's ability to operate in the principle of majority rule, essentially. Another area of reform, so I hope this is reformed the new executive order, that they get rid of the CIA veto. Another area is the problem of FRD information discussed earlier. ISU and the Public Interest Declassification Board, PIDIB, made a very good proposal a few years ago to treat FRD as national security information to make its declassification more feasible. Now, this would be a good reform for the Obama administration to consider in its current review of secrecy policy, that along with the CIA veto and other matters. But whatever that process results in, I hope that it leaves ISCAP in a strong or even stronger position to make the kinds of reasonable decisions on MDR appeals that it's been making during the last 10 years. Thank you.
We have over half an hour for discussion, but first I'd like to ask the panelists if they have any questions for each other. Nothing? Anything?
Well, I'd like to ask Dr. Burr, what do you think was the best in the sense of the most dramatic turnover of information that you received through the MDR ISCAP process?
Well, I think some of the documents that Bill showed earlier, the document Israel nuclear weapons, the thing on terrorism and the postmortem on the October War of 73. In two of those documents, the CIA had denied them altogether. They wouldn't even release a page, even on second appeal. So ISCAP just totally, you know, maybe they were able to twist some arms or reach some kind of consensus. I don't know what the process is. I guess it's like seeing sausages made. You don't want to know. I don't know. But nevertheless, ISCAP reversed the decisions. And on the October War, postmortem, pages and pages of the middle of the document were withheld in their entirety by CIA, even though they were actually information about other agencies' views on the possibility of war in the Middle East, like the State Department's INR's views, which was actually, they were kind of far-sighted in predicting the possibility of war. So ISCAP, again, the process reversed the earlier denials. So I think there's quite a few, those are more recent cases, but I've seen a lot of cases where stuff that had been denied altogether or massively denied, ISCAP was able to release. And a few cases, it's very rare where I haven't gotten anything from the ISCAP process. A couple times they held by the original decision to withhold a lot of material, but I can't even remember the cases where that happened. So I think I think it's a good process, really.
Yeah. Anything else from you all? We'll go to the audience. Yeah. In front.
Okay. I'm interested in the perspective of a repository where an agency has us and that the document could be located and considered by ISCAP.
So the question had to do with a non-governmental repository that had donated papers that contained classified information. They contacted the originator.
Unmarked
classified information.
Yeah, I contacted about the classified documents, and as a result of that, the alarm went up in NARA that we talked about the collection, and they said, my God, there's a whole series here that could have classified information, and then we got into a complete examination of the collection, which was fine. You think about that. But the question is, as a follow-up, if I'm not a researcher, but if I felt that there should, or the archivist felt that some of those documents perhaps should be considered, would the mechanics be in place to make that an efficient process?
Right. So the question is, how would you gain access to those materials that had been removed by agencies? I can tell you from a policy point of view, if an agency removed documents from your repository, they would need to have classified those documents. And it's possible to classify an unmarked document that contained classified information. Of course, they should have a complete inventory of those records, and you should be able to file a mandatory declassification and review request for those documents. So
is there anything that gives me a way to connect with what? See, what's disconcerting me is the fact that when I asked if it would be easy to locate that document to reconsider classification, the agent laughed.
Right. That is troubling.
That sounds like
that's not good.
That is troubling. Our panelists.
My suggestion would be to immediately file a mandatory review request for the review of those documents, and you might not get if the person has been out reviewing. You might not get any released, but what you would get made and created is a mandatory review file with numbers and copies of the documents in it back at whatever agency or agencies, and so that 5 years down the road, 7 years down the road, you can say, I asked for this mandatory review request. This is what you told me. I'm asking again, so that if they can't find, you know, if it's in Madam X's files and Madam X has retired, you know, in theory, we're all archivists. We know that there's a chance it's going to go away. But the mandatory review files are much more systematically kept. And if what you get is to keep it going, I would do it. I would appeal it. And given the topic, I would appeal to ISCAP. And we might not be able to release or might not think it appropriate to release more, but since the review was done, things continue to be reviewed both by NSC staff and by other agencies and continue to flow back into NARA so that what got taken from you in October may, 3 years from October, no longer be classified. It may, but it may not. But you will, if you appeal it, the general record schedule for a federal agency says they need to keep it longer than if you just do a mandatory review. And if you do an ISCAP appeal, I think you have to keep it even longer than that, so that the mandatory review files will stay as part of a record series for a longer time, pragmatically.
I would advise contacting the Information Security Oversight Office, one of our which is us. Yes. One of our responsibilities is to help non-governmental repositories with just this kind of issue. Anybody else? Sir, in the front, in the white shirt, sir. Okay. The questions had to do with what could possibly be still be classified from World War I, and the second question had to do what has the new administration been doing specifically to release information about activities from the previous administration. I can talk about the World War I document, or David, would you like to?
Feel free if you'd like to.
My understanding is that it's kind of a folk memory in the National Archives. There is a document from the World War I era that has to do with secret writing. So it's a specific formula for invisible ink or some other kind of secret writing technique, which another government agency, not the originating agency, the document I think was from Post Office Files or Office of Censorship, another government agency has identified that type of information to still require protection from public release. And regarding new administration?
New administration, release of things that went on in the last administration that one wishes hadn't gone on in the last administration. The primary example I can give you at the moment is the torture memos and the release of the documents that I would agree with Bill Carpenter should not have been classified in the first place. And while bits and pieces of them have been withheld, overwhelmingly, the large part of those documents have been released. The president's, on a slightly related topic, the first day the president went into office, he signed a memo telling agencies that in terms of the Freedom of Information Act, he was going to revert to what was known as the Reno memo, Attorney General Reno in the Clinton administration, saying the default is you release it. And only if there is, not because you could withhold it, but because it would cause harm if you did release it, that's going to be, again, the standard for Justice Department support. And there are two places in the federal government that are useful to have riding herd on things. One is the Office of Management and Budget, because if they won't fund it, you're not going to get very far. And the other is the Justice Department, because they're your lawyers. And if they're not going to back you in a lawsuit, a FOIA lawsuit, you're not going to do it. So when the Attorney General comes out and says, no, the standard for taking FOIA cases is you've got to show me recognizable harm, it leaves things out. In addition, as people have made mention of already, the executive order that covers all of this, Executive Order 12958, which was a Clinton and then slightly amended, but not seriously amended, executive order under Mr. Bush, is under serious review. My boss, Bill Leary, who is the senior advisor to the president, to the National Security senior advisor to the president on access and records management, has convened over the last several months a working group of people to look at it, what needs to happen, what needs to make changes. And I've not been specifically involved. I've been working on other things. But I will tell you that of all the things that kind of float up in the community of what's going to change and what's not going to change, I've not heard anybody say we need to move away from the 25-year assumption of automatic declassification. That seems to have become the given, and that things will be, the exception will be the World War I or World War II or Korea, or at this point, Vietnam documents that need to get held. I don't know what the new executive order looks like. It hasn't gone from my boss's desk up towards Mr. Obama yet, that I can't tell you, but I do know it's working. I would also say that one of the things, I spent Thursday pulling my hair out over the kind of thing that David was talking about, not quite World War I, but almost, but that they have tended to become the exception. There are pockets, and I think everybody in this office anybody in this row could tell you where the pockets are of things that haven't changed, but in any number of agencies, things have just changed dramatically. National Space Administration has basically said, before 1968, is it? There's nothing, everything that they had is automatically declassified. Just gone. Don't worry. Don't bother us about it anymore. And it's it is loosening up. It's not loosening up greatly at the moment in some places, but in other places it's phenomenally loosened up. So.
Anybody else?
But Bill may also have a different.
No, not really.
Yeah.
More questions? A lady in the green. Oh, gosh. The question has to do with information in U.S. documents that might be potentially damaging to other nations if released. Anybody like to answer that one?
The panelist that normally deals with that is the State Department panelist, and he's not here. But on occasion, yes, we do protect information that could be sensitive for political, or not political, but
foreign relations,
thank you, reasons, yes.
And that's done by the U.S. government because it, in our interest, just because it's foreign government information does not necessarily mean it will be protected. So. Anybody else?
Well, I could add to that. In cases that have been before the ICAP liaisons where the agency who owned the documents at our request went to their counterparts of the foreign government to discuss the document and in some cases, we were able to release information that government no longer considered sensitive to our relationship.
Is that kind of a routine thing to consult other governments about these documents, or something just on special occasions?
Well, Bill brought up the point I was just going to talk to. As Nick Murphy, who's our State Department colleague, says, the thing about going back to another government is you then pretty much have to take what they suggest you do. If you've made the diplomatic effort to go back and ask the Brits or the people who live in Oz what we should do about a document relating to the wizard, then you're pretty much stuck with saying okay. So that often we will look at it, and state is, in my experience, relatively good at saying, oh no, that world has turned around, or in some instances, no, the folks in Oz are extremely sensitive about what we say about their wizard. So even though it was printed in the local gutter press, we're not going to release it, kind of thing.
And there is a bit of a fine line that's drawn in foreign relations. You have the distinction between what we say that may affect our foreign relations and information that we get from other countries. And it's the information we get from other countries that a lot of times they'll take back to that country to make a determination. The stuff that's generated by our government in response or relating to foreign relations, we make the decisions on.
The gentleman in the white. There are two questions. The first one had to do with, has ICECAP as a body had the opportunity to comment on the revisions to the executive order? And the second had to do with declassification of sensitive compartmented information, having to do with communications intelligence or satellites. And would it be worth looking at those compartments as a whole to schedule a declassification of entire compartments? Panelists like to start on that one?
I'll take a shot at the first one. As far as the commenting goes, many of the principals that are the main members of ICECAP are our bosses, are on the group that is doing the revision to the executive order. And in fact, Mary's boss and Bill's boss are sort of the co-authors and chairs pushing this through. So yes, I think the answer to your question is yes, they have had a chance to comment on this. I know personally I have had a chance to look at it and comment to my principal on the issue. I can't speak for the rest of the members, the liaison level, but the principals, yes, have definitely had a say in the revision to the EO.
I understand that, but the question really is for ICE bosses to go through comments.
The comment had to do with perhaps this is an opportunity for the panel and then the liaisons to operate institutionally for comments to the order. And I think, as David Mengel said, that the principals are taking care of that, and the panel, the liaison level, is really constrained by those three functions that we have. As far as the second part of your question having to do with compartments, I know that those agencies that are concerned with those that kind of information periodically do conduct the reviews of certain kinds of satellite systems and other categories of compartmented information. So that kind of review is done periodically by National Reconnaissance Office and others.
So. But I would also tell you that one of the processes that or the practices the ICECAP liaisons have come around with almost plays against that. There are, as you know, code words that have been declassified, and there are what are called compartments that have been declassified. But some of those indicate at this point how the information was collected. And in many, in a good chunk of instances, what the ICECAP panel has done is kind of decided, okay, we will it's better to withhold the kind of chum around the top of a document, who sent it, who got it, how technically it came from one place to another, where all the different places it went to, withhold all of that so that we can release the substance of the document. The fact that Mary Ronan is giving this panel presentation reported back via, you know, the Wizard of Oz's CIA chief through Harry Potter, through whomever, we take all of that out so that we can leave in the substance of what's being said. And so I agree with you. The compartments are monstrously difficult to deal with. And let me give you more a NARA example of why they're especially monstrous to deal with is that the people who created them, not necessarily in the intelligence community, but elsewhere in this government, the people who created them are no longer there, and nobody knows what those mean. There's a story that one of the presidential libraries, having been open a couple of years, called one of their agency counterparts and said, okay, we've got these documents. They have this code word on them. How do you want us to transmit them to you? What does this mean? And the agency came back after about a week and said, damned if we know. And we're not talking here World War I or World War II documents. We're talking here documents that at this point were about 7 or 8 years old. So that's the other problem. And the problem is separating out what's a code word from what's a project name. And not conflating the two of them, which is often a difficult thing to do. So yeah, I think they're very hard to deal with.
I think that's what I was suggesting. Maybe you're the only starting point.
So the comment had to do with the use of administrative markings, non-classification markings for controlled unclassified information. The second one had to do with creating a listing of code words and compartments and things like that. I can talk about the first one. There is established within the Information Security Oversight Office a controlled unclassified information office that is currently in the policy review and development stage right now. So there is an initiative within the government to get a handle on all of that. And for the list there. Those markings above top secret, those are just access levels. So it's certainly the responsibility of the agencies who control that to do a good job in their own information management procedures. Any comments on that one?
No, but I personally think your suggestion of a compilation is either by ICU or ICECAP is certainly something to seriously consider.
More questions? In the back, yes. I'm sorry?
We can't hear you.
A little louder, I'm sorry.
We can't hear
you. Ah, yes. Yeah. The question had to do has the ICECAP ever had to review classified motion pictures or videotapes or things like that? An appeal has not risen to the ICECAP level for review yet, but I know that in our file we have a case where a researcher has requested a number of videotapes from the Department of Defense. We're still waiting for those documents or those videotapes to be delivered to our door so we can put them before the panel. So record type, any record type can be appealed. If it's classified, it can be reviewed, it can be appealed to the ICECAP. It's a little bit of a challenge, especially for imagery. There have been cases where, in the past, where representatives from the ICAP have had to go to offices that created this type of imagery so they can review the records there for background purposes.
I have some requests for classified films held in ours. So sooner or later, they'll percolate to an ICAP.
Yes, and audio.
Plus, I'm lucky.
Well.
And my colleague sitting next to me in his younger days was all too intimately familiar with what it is like to try and review audio tapes, which are probably even worse than video images. And it's not an easy, it's not a pleasant task. So,
right, we would have to have the ability to identify certain portions for redaction for videotapes. In the front, in purple. Well, you'll need to treat all marked classified in the same way for safeguarding purposes. Hopefully, it wouldn't get to the point where it's gone out to the researcher. Hopefully, you'd find it in processing. But you'd need to document who had access to this. The question had to do with what should non-governmental repositories do if they find marked classified in their collections. Record who saw it and when. Safeguard it as best you can. In control of one person, indicate who's seen this kind of material in the past. And call our office. Call the Information Security Oversight Office. We've dealt with this kind of situation in the past, and we will continue to deal with it in the future. It's worth calling the Information Security Oversight Office, perhaps rather than the originating agency. We can coordinate safeguarding requirements and coordinate with the originating agency to get this information declassified.
You have a call. You had a question.
I think Kelly had one in the back.
In the back. Questions? In the back. Yes. The question had to do with in what format do we review records? If the record's in electronic format, do we have the capability to review it electronically? Most of the cases that have come to ICAP in the past have been on paper, but our panelists want to...
I can take a shot at that. Sure. We actually have had requests for both electronic media that we've done both ways. We have electronic records in a classified system. Right now, we have no way to export those records in a format that's usable, electronic format that's usable by the public. So we do actually print out records. We have been involved with review of specifically the State Department cables from 73 to 76, where the review has been done electronically, and they have a public use version available that we can use. That review mostly has been done by the State Department, although we do a follow-up privacy review and review for other sensitivities within those records. But, yeah, we are starting to get a lot more of that. Our system right now is capable to do doing searches in classified records and pulling all those records for us. We're moving toward the day when we can actually refer those records electronically to agencies. What I'd like to see in the near future, hopefully, is a system that we can work with agencies without having to actually send them things, or we can connect in and, you know, do all the hocus-pocus technical stuff that people like to do, and do that in a more efficient manner.
We, at the moment, not for ICAP, because ICAP, all the members and or liaisons of ICAP do not have access to a classified system. So we've become adroit at sending out messages to each other in an unclassified form, as in look at page 12, line 16. But one of the other hats I wear is as looking at pre-publication review, and I have access to a classified computer system a classified internet system, and I will tell you it cuts down amazingly on time, effort, and ultimately money to be able to get electronic copies of a book to be reviewed that way. It's done. We don't have to scan it in. We can look at it this way, and we can go back and forth more easily and get work. Answers for the requesters much more quickly. You know, the concept of using a defense courier system to get things from the Reagan Library to Washington, which can add a month at each end of the request, is madness.
But. I think we have time for one more question. If not, I'd like to thank our panel and thank you all for coming this morning.